Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I'm your host, Aaron Roller, here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Correct.
Oh.
Tried to throw you off there.
Is that who you are?
That's me.
Okay. What's going on? Anything new happening?
No, we've been through this before. You live a far more interesting life than I do. So largely no. Anything going on with you?
I took my daughter to the Philadelphia Museum of Art today.
Ah, there you go. See, far more interesting than anything that I did today.
We saw a really cool exhibit I would recommend to anybody who's in the Philadelphia area. It's wearable art. It's all kind of fabric art. And we saw one that Kayla saw and said, that is Yosef's coat. And I took a picture of it, and I'll probably put it on our on the show's Facebook page next week so people can check it out when we get to the Ketonet Passim. So that was, I don't know how exciting that is, but she thought it was cool. And I thought it was cool too, actually.
Pretty cool.
Good exhibit.
Pretty cool.
All right. So Parshat Vayishlach, that's what we're going to read this week. It deals with the journey that Yaakov Avinu makes from the house of Lavan, his father-in-law, where he and his family have beat as hasty a retreat as somebody with 11 children and 3 wives, one of whom is pregnant, can possibly make. He also apparently has lots and lots of livestock, not just the sheep that we learned about last week, but all kinds of animals. And he is on his way back to Canaan, to the home of his father, and he finds out that Esav is coming to confront him. It's been 20 years since he saw his brother, and he is afraid that he is going to be vengeful, still hold this grudge and be murderous at the fact that Yaakov took the blessing 20 years before. So that's where the parsha begins, and it really takes us through their journey pretty much back to Canaan and what happens on the way, and it's not a very pleasant story. We get, in addition to the encounter with Esav, Yaakov, before Esav, has a wrestling match with a mysterious person/angel. His daughter is kidnapped and raped, which is certainly not good. What else happens? Oh, and Rachel dies in childbirth. So it's not the most upbeat of Torah portions this week.
Kind of morbid when you put it the way that you just did.
Yeah, I don't think we think about this as being like such a distinctly difficult or sad parsha.
It's a downer.
Yeah. So anyway, the thing I wanted to talk about was the wrestling match. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about, but I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of the parsha.
I'm sorry. Is that why you're dressed like Hulk Hogan this evening?
Yes.
I could not figure out for the life of me why you were wearing that shirt that says Portion Mania and why you have dyed your Fu Manchu blonde.
Get in the cage, Bienenfeld! Get in the cage! I'll take you on!
It all makes sense now.
To be fair, that's also why you've slapped into a Slim Jim.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You liked wrestling as a kid, I'm guessing.
Loved wrestling when I was a kid. Loved it.
I was never into it.
Loved it. I was so into it. I loved it.
I mean, I can't say, like, I watched it for sure.
I'm kind of surprised that you weren't, because I know you were a big comic book guy.
And so I like the hero-villain aspect.
Yeah, that just did it for me. The whole idea of these, like, larger-than-life figures who just, you know, who could just beat up all the bad guys was so exciting.
They were so silly, though. It was...
Yeah.
I don't know. I felt like if they were really enemies with each other, they should really be hurting each other, not just waiting till they're in a ring.
Yeah, fair enough. You can ask all kinds of questions.
Right. You have to be willing to suspend disbelief.
Now, I didn't. I don't know if this comes as a surprise to our listeners. I grew up Jewish, so I never had the opportunity to have the great myth of Santa Claus dispelled. But I remember distinctly. When my father explained to me that wrestling was not real. And it was, I don't know, it wasn't nearly as heartbreaking as I guess it as I guess it should have been, but I kept on watching.
Well, I would think you have to know. I mean, I think most people who are into it know that it's not
Also, just the sheer athleticism.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Even though the plot lines are fake, they really are body slamming each other.
Yeah. That's really gotten that got better and better in as the, I don't want to call it a sport, but as the mode of entertainment evolved, there's more athleticism on display. Probably more so now, I would assume, than there ever was.
I wouldn't know. I don't know. This was never. Like I said, I liked the costumes. I liked the Undertaker.
Scary dude.
Yeah, that guy seemed
scary dude.
He was intense. But anyway, so it's, yeah, I mean, how come nobody ever adapted the Saro Shel Esav wrestling identity? That would have been a great, you know,
I think you have to think a little too much for that. I think
cerebral.
The whole idea was to not have to think too much. This was an escape from the world of having to think.
All right. Well, with that in mind, let's try to place this a little bit, because it's a very, I mean, the Torah is so terse so much of the time, gives so little information, whole portions of people's lives go kind of unsaid, and then we get this amazing imagery for Yaakov, right? They're passing over a river, and and Rashi talks about Yaakov acting as like a bridge that he's taking.
Right.
He's taking his children and his wives and his animals, and he's carrying them from one bank of the river to the other, and then he goes back for these pachim ktanim, these small vessels, which there's all kinds of interpretations that are built into the idea of the small vessels, right?
Yes.
Like there's the idea that, firstly, the idea of just being, right? It's like a chacham chasal mamono. Is that what they say?
Exactly. Tzadik chasal mamono. The idea that this is something that Hashem gave me. And there's this relationship that exists with God down to the most minute of details. That it's like if this was the little clay hummus container that I had, then I'm meant to have it, and it's part of me. On a more simplistic level, the idea that time is money, and that if I need to replace whatever it is that I lost, then that's time away from more religious and spiritual pursuits in the interest of being able to refurnish myself with whatever I lost from the material world.
But if it doesn't spark happiness, then can you get rid of it?
Oh, like that lady.
Marie Kondo.
That's what she.
I think it's different in the age of mass produced recyclable junk.
Yeah, I guess so. I remember it's a show, right?
And they made it into a show. It was a book.
It was a book. It was a small little book.
The life-changing
art, of cleaning up. Whatever it was.
We're really with it.
I remember seeing that line, and I was just so taken aback by it. It seemed so, I don't know. It seemed, and I get the idea, and I get the intention, but there's something about framing things.
Tidying up. The life-changing something of tidying up.
So the idea that if it brings me no joy, if it brings me no happiness, to get rid of it. Meaning I do appreciate the idea that there's so much stuff that we have around, and we need to kind of look in the mirror at some point and wonder why it is that we have all this stuff, and is it purposeful in any which way? As I'm looking at your bookcase after bookcase.
Overflowing after bookcase. Bookcases of books, some of which I've never even read. But I will one day,
one
maybe.
Day. So yeah, I get that. But there seems something like so self-absorbed about putting it in that manner.
Well,
like if it brings me no joy, well, or almost I don't know about almost like irresponsible. Like, does everything that I sometimes things just fulfill a purpose, and I need that purpose fulfilled. I need that role filled, and that's what this object does. And I don't know if it brings me any joy, but like I need to have it.
I once worked with a man. He actually went into retirement towards the end of the project we worked on together, and he was really opinionated guy. And I don't remember what the context was, but he was talking about retaining. I guess probably retaining some records for something we were doing. And he goes, "Better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it." And I said, that sounds like the credo of a hoarder. And he said, yeah. So, and then anyway, but the point is...
So, Murray, if you're listening, this one's
Alan,
for
Alan. If I see a listener in Hawaii, he was a civil servant who had, over years of saving, bought himself a house in Hawaii that he was planning to retire to.
Nice.
So it was a good strategy.
Hope
but any,
he's enjoying.
Yeah, me too. But anyway, the point is that Yaakov is going back for these small vessels and ties into Hanukkah, right? The Pach Shemen. I've heard Divrei Torah about
great.
That. That okay. you know, because the of course the Maccabees had to find the small little vessel Ketanim, and right. that had the pure oil in it. There's a lot of ideas that come out of this this Pachim Ketanim. He goes back for these small vessels and he encounters this. It says a man, but the midrashic interpretation and certainly a tradition is that this is no man, but this is an angel, and this is not just any angel, but this is an angel, which is this idea we had this idea last week of angels for a nation, right? That the angels who are accompanying Yaakov in the land
right.
of Israel go up the ladder, and the ones who are going to accompany him outside the land of Israel go down the ladder, and then in this week's Torah portion we get the idea of angels for specifically either people or nations, that this is the angel that represents Esav on a spiritual, metaphysical level. This is a really odd concept. I don't know if you have, do you have anything, any deeper explanation for what this might mean?
Not really, other than I wanted to point this out, and maybe we'll kind of circle back to this at the end of this conversation. But one of the things that I've, and I still don't have my head really wrapped around this, so I'm interested in kind of hearing your thoughts and being able to figure this out with you a little bit. But just the contrast between the interaction that Yaakov has with this guardian angel of Esav and the interaction that he has with Esav himself. Meaning this somehow or another is meant to foreshadow, I would think, the interaction that they're going to have. Remember, Yaakov is afraid. He's concerned. He knows that Esav is coming. He gets wind of the fact that if Esav is coming and he's armed to the hilt and he has 400 men coming along with him and this whole army, and he just assumes that this is going to be an all-out war. And what ends up happening is that he has this struggle with the guardian angel of Esav, but then he ends up having no struggle whatsoever with Esav himself. And those two must be related somehow or another, that there are these like spiritual forces at play that actually help to dictate, determine the actions that we'll see of human beings, or something that takes place up in the spiritual realm then has these repercussions down in the physical realm, whatever it is that looks like. But I think that that's an important way of sort of casting this episode, that this is an altercation with this angel that's meant to represent Esav, but then subsequently the actual interaction that Esav has, I'm sorry, that Yaakov has with his real life brother with Esav is far more muted than we would have expected, and even far more muted than the scuffle that he has with the angel.
It's interesting. It's interesting in the sense that what is the real struggle? You would think an angel would be much more dangerous, a much more serious encounter than with a human being. On the other hand, right, it's very much, we read it as being kind of like the preview for, like, in other words, for the, it's like the rehearsal. Like, is it the rehearsal or is that the actual fight? And Rashi certainly frames it, right? He reads into some of Yaakov's words that of like, oh, I'd have to go and probably go find the verse, but Rashi definitely says that Yaakov kind of intimates, oh, I saw your angel and I bested him, so watch out. Like that, there's
I'm not afraid of you
kind
either.
Of an allusion to the fact that that was the real fight. The fact that I could take him down meant you better watch out.
Which
for
makes
me.
A lot more sense, because if it's just an attempt at rehearsing whatever it is that's going to take place, like it's the dress rehearsal or it's the practice round. So then the real interaction, altercation, call it what you will, doesn't follow that pattern at all, right? It's far more it's far more muted. It's not nearly as intense. I mean, Esav effectively melts. He melts into Yaakov's arms.
Well, so here's the thing is, I wonder, would you go so far as to say then? And, you know, it gets tricky because We know, you know, Angels are not. This is certainly physical. It's a physical fight. He is actually physically injured, right? He's injured in the thigh region. But you could also look at it as being very, very internal. Not like it's all in his own head, right? But on a certain level, and I love this idea. There's these parallels between Yaakov, you know, when he leaves and his leaving the land of Israel and his coming back to the land of Israel. Right, he talks about, you know, my stick that I crossed this river with, that he's when he leaves, he only has the stick, and now he has a whole family. Like, there's a moment here that is, like, it's the homecoming moment, and it's like I think he's seeing it, and I think we're meant to see it as being, like, coming full circle, and remember that. Geographically, I don't know how well it lines up, but certainly in terms of as we're reading it, right, Yaakov's leaving the land of Israel is when he has his dream. And it's also when he, in our tradition, in the reading that the rabbis give, is when he invents the evening prayer, right? Yaakov is, of the three patriarchs, he's the father that represents the nighttime, that represents exile, that represents uncertainty. So to have him here again in the nighttime, in the uncertainty, by himself, even after he's had all this success, right? He finds himself alone again. And he finds himself just over the border, outside the land of Israel again. And he has this, like, it's really seems, and then I'm thinking of this now. And he has an encounter with an angel again. Like, again. That's kind of amazing, actually.
Right. They're like bookends in terms of his
I think they really
exiting
are.
From and then his entry back into Israel. And as far as we know, this is the last time that he's seen an angel.
Yeah, so think about this, right? He wakes up from that dream when he is leaving the land of Israel, and he says, he has this assurance that God is going to be with him, and he says, but he reading the language literally, and I think the commentaries try to kind of dodge the literal reading a little bit. It sounds very conditional, right? He says, like, if God will be with me, then I'll give 10%, and I think we said ourselves last week, like, of course he believes God is going to be with him. This is Yaakov Avinu we're talking about. But it is the sort of conditional thing. Like, he is, in a sense, even if we don't read it literally, I think there's a level at which the text is trying to convey to us that he's a person who suffers from doubt on a certain level. And I think it's true in many instances in his life, in many instances in this week's parsha, actually. But so to see him in this moment of intense doubt again, right, as he's about to re-encounter his brother and have this struggle, which ends with the angel saying to him, you're good. You've bested me. You've wrestled with people. You've wrestled with angels. And you come out on top. So it's like, it almost comes to tell us, if we're going to personalize it, and I think I'm reading a lot into it here, but, like, it almost tells us as individuals that maybe we never stop struggling. That, like, maybe we should. Maybe we have to have the faith to do so. But, like, that Yaakov Avinu, even after everything he's been through, 20 years and all the success he's had and the multiple wives and the multiple children, which, again, on a you know, prophetic, midrashic level, he knows these are going to be the tribes of Israel. He knows he's building it out. He and now he's on his way back. He should be, you know, in if not in triumph, because he is going to encounter Esav again, at least feeling more confident. And yet, it doesn't seem like that.
And or it's a reminder that it would be a mistake to be overly confident, because he actually ends up injured. He ends up having this very difficult encounter, and it doesn't go nearly as smoothly as anybody would have liked. So if he has some measure of doubt, then he's right to. And if he doesn't have any doubt, then he would have been mistaken.
So, if I may, I really think that, I think Yaakov, and I think tradition intends this, is the one of the patriarchs who is kind of the most, he's difficult to understand, but on one level, because, you know, the stealing of the birthright, doesn't it seem like he's less, somewhat less than ethical? But on the other hand, he's also the most relatable, in the sense that he is the only one of the patriarchs that we really hear about his struggles working for a living. We really hear about I mean, Avraham, it's in these almost much more, like he goes and he fights a war and he wins. Like, we don't hear about struggle in the same way.
And I think those two go hand in hand. I don't think that those are conflicting realities. I think the reason why Yaakov becomes so much more relatable, why we consider ourselves to be B'nai Yaakov and B'nai Yisrael, why we consider Yaakov to be this, you know, Yaakov represents the Midah of Tiferes, which is this harmony that exists between the Midos and the characteristics that were exemplified by the two patriarchs before him. And that we know so much about him and that we know so much about his struggles, and he's so relatable for all those reasons because that's so much closer to what we experience as real life than what we see from his predecessors, from his father and his grandfather. Those dimensions of his story and of his backdrop that are a little bit more murky, like on the one hand, it almost seems sort of unethical, and yet he has his mother whispering in his ear that this is exactly what he's supposed to do. He's concerned more about appearances, that his father might interpret this to be some act of treachery, far more than he seems to be concerned as a function of his own internal conscience that he's actually doing anything wrong. And those are exactly the kinds of struggles that we live with. Meaning we're always beset by those kinds of things. And who am I doing this for? Am I really doing this for myself? Am I doing this for God? Am I doing this for others? Am I doing this for my own ego? Am I doing this for in the service of others? Or do I just want the recognition that others will give me as a result? And I'm not suggesting, I just want to be clear, I'm not suggesting that Yaakov was beset really by the same degree of issues and of doubt and almost self-treachery or self-deception that we do, but they're at least on a more similar wavelength, even if a little bit higher up in kind than what we see with respect to Avraham and Yitzchak.
And given all that, I think it's very much in keeping with his character and in keeping with the lessons that he has for us, that he emerges victorious, but he doesn't emerge unscathed.
Exactly right. That you give something up, and that there is something that you're going to walk around with these battle scars forever. You know, Rev Soloveitchik says something very, very interesting about this struggle, which is that the purpose for the struggle is completely unclear. And as much as Yaakov receives this ringing endorsement from the angel that, you know what, I'm not even going to change your name because you can't just go by Yaakov anymore. You need a name that is representative of everything that this struggle was, that you have quarreled, you have struggled both with human beings and then also with the divine or with the angelic or with the spiritual element, and you've emerged and you've overcome that vatuchal, you've been capable. And yet, as much as that's the case, like, what were they fighting over? What were they fighting? There was no land won. This wasn't part of some empire that needed to be built. There wasn't any. As much as Yaakov goes back for his own pachim katanim, it's not like he finds the angel who's you know, holding on to it. He said, hey, give it here. No, you know, finders keepers, losers weepers. And they get into a fight over this little earthenware jug. It's completely unclear, specifically so, and intentionally so, as to what exactly they were fighting over. And Rav Soloveitchik says that's really the point of this entire episode. It is to remind us that when it comes to Yaakov, when it comes to Yisrael, when it comes to who we are, when it comes to the name that we actually identify ourselves by as a nation and as a land, that it is the struggle itself that becomes critical and that becomes important, sometimes just for its own sake, meaning that if we aren't struggling and if we aren't grappling with whatever it is, with our religious identity, then we have no religious identity. Meaning if it's all a cakewalk and it's all a piece of cake and it's all just this natural progression of another step after another step after another step, and everything exactly what I'm supposed to do is completely clear and it's obvious and it's perfect and everything is just so completely lucid, then we're really missing the point. We're meant to struggle, and we're meant to find that things are complicated and complex, and we're meant to try to wring out every last brain cell and every last fiber of our spirit and trying to not only actually perform what we're supposed to perform, but even figure out what it is that we're supposed to be doing. And this whole quarrel, it's rather unclear what the objective is. Soloveitchik says that in no small measure, that's exactly the point.
So I think, did you, it's a little bit like what you spoke about in Shul this past Shabbos, right? Didn't you talk about how, like, just to ask the question, just to ask, where is Hashem?
Yeah, what you're referring to, I quoted a great insight from the Kutzker Rebbe, which is just this, it's just a beautiful reread of a line that we say all the time. We say it in Kedusha, and it's a line that's taken from the angelic hosts that just sing Hashem's praises, that they say, Ayye Makom Kuvodo. And it sounds like it's this seek Aye, where is Makom Kuvodo, the place of his glory, the place of his honor. And the way that it's usually interpreted, or the way that it's usually punctuated and then translated, is that they are seeking out the place. There's this pining for Hashem, where is the place of his kavod? And the way that the Kutzker says it or reads it is that no, it's Aye. Aye, when you ask, when you say, where is Hashem, when you seek out Hashem, that is Makom Kavodo. That is the place of his glory. And it's the place where, the way that at least I had heard it, I mean, it's an interesting spin, but the way at least I had heard it is that when you're in a place that is difficult and that's dark and Hashem's presence isn't overt and there's what we call Hester Panim, it's the concealed presence of God. But if you make a point of saying Aye, that I'm here to find you and I want to know you and I want you to be close to me, then you've effectively already found the place of his kavod. I think there's if I'm getting you right, it's saying that Aye is also representative of a struggle. I mean, it's this difficulty in seeing him, and in part that's exactly what we're meant to do. It's not going to be crystal clear.
Yeah, I think it has to be right. I think it has to be that the person who says where is it is the person who's looking for something. Like to be actively involved in a search, to be actively involved in a struggle, I think that speaks to
the objective isn't so readily available.
So to wrap it up, I think that really speaks to what prepares Yaakov for encountering his brother. That I would say, like, you could just unpack the exchange between them. We could do like numerous other shows, and maybe in future years we will. He bows, the way he, you know, he lines up his family. I mean, there's so much interpretation in all these different things. Where is his daughter at this time? There's so much going on. But the one thing that I think comes out of what we've been discussing is that Esav says, "Let's go on together." And Yaakov says, "I got to take it slow. The children are young, and the animals can't be run along too hard. We're going to go at our own pace, and I'll get to you eventually." And I think that is very much part and parcel of a person who A, knows who he is, and knows that he is not a person who has it all figured out. He knows that he has to take it slow. He knows that he has a lot of responsibilities. He knows that it's not simple. There's no easy answers. I think Esav maybe represents easy answers in a certain regard. He's very much of this world. He says, I've got it all, basically. And he feels that way. Versus Yaakov says, you know, I think you could draw the line between saying he has this struggle the night before, and he emerges knowing I can't go at your pace, Esav, and I don't want to be in the same place that you are. I've got to go slow. I've got to be mindful. I've got to occasionally struggle. I'm going to have to take whatever hits are going to come my way. And certainly before the end of the parsha, there's going to be more than a couple of hits. But that's the reality of Yaakov Avinu, and that's the reality of the lesson he has to teach us.
Yeah, the reality of trying to spend your life fusing two worlds together is a far more complex reality and complex experience than what it is that Esav is after. Esav lives squarely in this world. Esav has an interest in the material goods and the physical bounty and sustenance that this world has to offer. That was the bracha that he was really primed for, and that was the bracha that Yaakov took from him. But it was a bracha that is taken in an interest of hopefully serving and servicing the other half of that bracha, which is that Yaakov is going to assume the mantle of Avraham, and that becomes a much more delicate straddling of the fence than anything that Esav really needs to concern himself with. So Yaakov being this, you know, he's this physical person, he's this physical being who has this quasi-physical encounter with this spiritual angel. You know, the way that I think of it, there was this, there's this, I don't remember the context exactly, there's this scene in The Matrix where Neo wakes up from, maybe it was his fight with Morpheus, whatever it is, he wakes up, something happens when he's under, and he wakes up and he puts his finger in his mouth and he's bleeding. And he's like totally confused because he knows that it's all fake. And somebody says to him, right, the body cannot live without the mind. And that's how I kind of think about this whole interaction, that yes, he walks away with this physical limp, but I don't know if this was even...
Was there really a person
was
there?
Was there a person? Was there a physical struggle? Hmm. Was this all in the mind? Was this all in the spirit? Was this, you know, some kind of out-of-body sort of experience? But he walks away with a physical limp because that's what Yaakov is. That's exactly what he's trying to do. He's trying to create a fusion between Shemayim and Aretz. And I think it's a great point that when he comes upon Esav, he says, you know what? You can just make a beeline for whatever it is that you're going. Every step that I take needs to be so much more calculated than anything you could possibly imagine because of what I'm trying to accomplish with my existence.
All right. So sounds good.
Word.
The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. The music is The Magid Niggin by Simply Tzvat. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. And I'm going to really, if you made it to the end of the show, tell 3, 4, or 5 friends. The numbers are ticking up in listenership, but I'm making a little push. Definitely tell your friends. I say it every week, but I'm going off script and saying it some more. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us, leave a review, and you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn.